Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, November 11th. If you've seen the New York Times today in print or online, it's one of those days with only one big headline at the top of page one: election officials nationwide find no fraud. Then it says, statements amount to forceful rebuke of Trump's false claims. The Times contacted officials representing both parties in almost every state who said that there were no irregularities that affected the outcome. And then it goes state by state. Washington Post columnist Henry Olson provides a simple but big picture analysis of how we can tell the election was not stolen. He writes, since we elect presidents through the Electoral College, if fraud were behind President-elect Joe Biden's win, we should expect to see significantly higher turnout increases in key states when compared to the nation as a whole. Furthermore, we should expect to see higher turnout increases within those states in Democratic areas than in Republican areas, since those regions are places where Democrats are more likely to be able to hide any stolen votes. Finally, we should expect to see significantly larger shifts in voter margins toward the Democrats from other previous elections as the fraud alters the area's normal voting patterns. None of these early warning signs of fraud appear in the results. That from Washington Post columnist Henry Olson. Here's one example of a suit that shows both how broadly they're trying to disqualify votes and how contradictory it can be when they go that broad. The Times reports that on Monday, the Trump campaign filed a lawsuit in the seven Pennsylvania counties where the president lost that claimed mail voting itself, just the fact of mail voting, created an unfair two-tiered system during the election, though the system, the Times reminds us, is also in place in counties the president won. So can he really try to suppress every mail-in vote, but then just pick off the counties he lost in? Can he really get whole states to nullify their results just on the basis of having used a lot of mail-in voting? Most legal experts doubt it. Almost every legal expert doubts it. But that's what they're trying, or part of it. And still the campaign continues with another lawsuit filed in Michigan yesterday and a big collection of rallies in support of these claims now planned for Saturday in Washington. They're calling it things like the Million MAGA March. Have you heard that one yet? The Million MAGA March. As Politico reports, the disparate tribes of MAGA Nation, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, InfoWars fanatics, Groypers, Proud Boys, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, and the people who would simply call themselves diehard MAGA have declared that they are simply going to show up in Washington en masse over the weekend to rally together with the marquee event on Saturday. That from Politico. I guess it will be long on spectacle, short on evidence. What matters now is what happens in court. With us now, Jane Mayer, chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker and author of books including the 2016 bestseller Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, which began as a 2010 New Yorker piece about the Koch brothers' deep influence on American politics. She also wrote the 2008 bestseller The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Her current article is called Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose. It details some of the more than a dozen lawsuits and criminal investigations, plus daunting financial obligations that Trump will have to face once he no longer has the unique protection of being president of the United States. Thanks for coming on, Jane. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Your article was written, we should say, a few days before Election Day, and quotes various people who predicted exactly what Trump is doing now. For example, his former lawyer, Michael Cohen. What did Michael Cohen or anyone else see coming?
Well, Michael Cohen, it turns out, knew him quite well. He'd been working with him for years. And I'd say his prediction was among the most accurate. He said that President Trump would never, ever, ever concede, that he would claim fraud. He would claim that dead people voted, people who'd never been born had voted, come up with all kinds of excuses, anything to say other than that he'd lost the election because the public had turned against him. He clearly was right about that. There were a number of people who also thought that it was possible that that Trump might eventually flee the country, or that he basically would try to pretend or suggest that he's running again in order to seem like he's got a movement that's still alive.
So where it really matters is in the courtroom right now. And when he runs out of options by the deadline to certify votes, that's when Joe Biden will really be the president-elect officially, not just based on the obvious math and the lack of evidence to the contrary, but officially when the votes are certified in the states. But I wonder sometimes about it just taking a few Judge Roy Moores or people like that going up the chain to a friendly Supreme Court, and maybe something like that Pennsylvania suit trying to disqualify every mail-in ballot, that it might look rational and reasonable to just enough of a sliver of conservative judges. Does anything like that keep you up at night?
It literally kept me up last night. I woke up at 3 in the morning and started doom scrolling on Twitter. I was so nervous about what's going on. I, like you, am somebody who finds this whole situation fairly alarming. It's so unusual. We've never seen anything like this in this country. It's beginning to have the feel of someplace like Belarus or some kind of third world country. I do worry about it. And there are sort of kind of, extreme and probably unlikely scenarios, but there are possibilities for making terrible mischief in this thing. That it is possible, I suppose, that in Pennsylvania, the legislature, which is dominated by Republicans, could try to disqualify the electors who've been elected and are supposed to deliver their votes for Biden, and they could try to put up a new slate of their own that contest that. And one of the things that Michael Cohen, who you mentioned at the start of this interview, the former lawyer for Trump, who knows him so well, said was that the reason that Trump rushed to put Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court was because he wanted a friendly court there so that when he contests this election, he can, win in front of the Supreme Court. I mean, this takes, elaborate conspiracy theory planning, and I'm not generally a believer in conspiracy theories, but there is the possibility for extreme mischief if things went horribly awry. And there are beginning to be some of the experts on the subject of authoritarianism, such as Timothy Snyder, who's a professor at Yale University who studies autocracies in Eastern Europe and elsewhere in the world, who are beginning to sort of sound alarm signals. He is saying today that it's not enough to just win the election. That's only the first step in places where democracy is under attack. And he's saying if the Democrats want to hold on to this Biden win, they need to start flooding the streets with popular protests and not just let the Proud Boys be the people protesting in Washington. They need to support the Democratic outcome, Snyder is saying. So it has a very dangerous feel to it.
And one of the things that worries me the most is one of the things you mentioned, that state legislatures might give themselves reason in Republican states that are swing states like Pennsylvania, like Wisconsin, to somehow declare without a court ruling that the vote was inconclusive, despite lack of evidence of voter fraud that would close the margin. And say, well, it's inconclusive because we can't tell because there were so many mail-in ballots that could be subject to fraud or whatever, and seize control of the electoral votes and then really be done with this whole 200-year experiment in democracy. That's the one that keeps me up at night. Your article is called Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose, and your article mentions that Trump's businesses have not done well while he's been president. What can you tell us about that, since I think many people assume it's been a boon to his businesses, like we hear about the Emoluments Clause and all these people who try to cozy up to Trump by staying at his hotels?
Yeah, and I think it's worth, you know, before digging into the details, if you step back, why is Trump fighting so hard to stay in the White House? As long as he's in the White House, he has the presumption of immunity from lawsuits and certain protections that go along with that high office. But as soon as he's out, he faces a kind of a nightmarish number of problems, and among them are in his business empire, which it now, thanks to the incredible reporting by the New York Times, we've had a look at the details of his tax returns, and we can see that he is about to face $300 million in loans coming due that he has personally signed for in the next 4 years. And so he's got to come up with that $300 million. He's personally backing it. It's actually over $300 million. In addition, he's been fighting with the IRS, which is disallowing $100 million more in deductions that he took. And if he so far he's been losing that case, apparently. If he continues to lose it, he'll owe $100 million on top of the first $300 million. There are an additional many hundreds of millions of dollars of loans coming due on his business that he's not personally backing. Cumulatively, I think it comes to about $900 million. So he's deeply, deeply in debt. He could sell off some assets, presumably, but at this particular moment, the kinds of assets he's got, which are resorts, real estate that are resorts and office buildings, their value has plummeted because of the pandemic. So he is in a tight squeeze. It's not a place anybody would want to be.
You know, your article got me wondering if a prime motivation for this whole post-election drama might be finance. I see the fundraising emails that go out. I don't know if you're on those lists, but there are many per day since the election, just like before the election. One has the subject line, voter fraud. And when you open it, it doesn't make any kind of argument for that being real. It just says, it's time to fight back. Can President Trump count on you? And then it asks for money. Another one just this morning has the subject line, can you chip in? And when you open it, it says, if every patriot chips in $5, President Trump and Vice President Pence will have what it takes to defend the election and win. So they're making claims about voter fraud. They're making claims that they can still win and raising money off that. So I'm wondering, Jane, if it might be that Trump wound up with a lot of campaign debt and that he's raising more money now than he's spending on the legal briefs, and that's a part of this. Any idea?
Oh, I think for sure you're onto something there. If you take a look at the fine print in those solicitations that Trump is sending out to people, he's saying that this money is going to go to his defense fund and fighting these election cases. And in fact, if you look at it carefully, that money is going to retire his campaign debt and God knows where else. This is going to be just a huge engine for raising money for Trump and already is. We can see that.
On the other hand, isn't it very easy for an ex-president to make money? They can charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for speeches. Hillary Clinton, even as an ex-first lady and a senator and ex-secretary of state or whenever exactly those speeches to Goldman Sachs were that, got blowback during the 2016 campaign for $250,000 and things like that. It's really easy for an ex-president to make gobs of money, isn't it?
Well, ever since it really started with Gerald Ford, he started going out on the speaking circuit and making money. And sure, they can make money. I mean, you know, it's money that looks like big, big money to someone like me who's a reporter. But for Donald Trump, you know, $250,000 for a speech here and there, or even $1 million or $2 million, which is what some of the other presidents, former presidents, have gotten. It's not that big of money when you owe $300 million on your debts coming due, and $100 million more to the IRS. He's going to need a lot of money. And in addition to the problems, of course, in his business empire, are the legal problems he's got. I mean, those are going to be very it's going to be expensive to pay the legal bills, and it's also, I mean, the case, particularly the one in New York, is a serious case that the Manhattan DA seems to be investigating against Trump. So he's facing some very serious perils.
Question from a listener via Twitter. It says, hasn't it occurred to anyone yet that Trump is waiting to be offered a no-jail immunity deal in exchange for leaving peacefully like Nixon? So do you think that's a possible scenario?
You know, that was actually floated. It was one of the people I interviewed for the story I did for the New Yorker, Joe Lockhart, who was somebody who had been in the Clinton administration, suggested some kind of global deal in exactly that. Go peacefully, and exchange. We'll drop the prosecution that seems most serious, which is the one in New York, the DA's office in New York. That would require Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney, going along with it. There seemed to be, the people I interviewed, quite a dispute about whether he would consider such a deal. He's a lawyer, and this is a criminal case, and what message does it send if you can make a deal and just drop charges against someone because they're too important to prosecute? That's one way of looking at it. The other people were arguing, but before he's a lawyer, he's a politician, and he may see this as a way to sort of unify the country. So I don't know how that will play out, but I think it's a possibility.
Yeah, and related to that, you tackle the idea in your article of a pardon of Trump, which could be by Trump himself, or he could resign before Biden takes office if Mike Pence agrees to pardon him. And you also examine the possibility of Biden pardoning Trump through the lens of President Gerald Ford having pardoned Nixon to help the country move on. And one detail that caught my eye was that Ford cited an old Supreme Court decision that said accepting a pardon implies an admission of guilt. And you remind us in your piece that Ford had gotten so much blowback for pardoning Nixon that one of the ways that he justified it in future public appearances was to say that there was an old Supreme Court decision that said accepting a pardon implies an admission of guilt. And that made me wonder if you think Trump's psychological makeup might resist a pardon for himself for exactly that reason, because it comes with a taint of an admission of guilt.
Well, I think what we know about Trump is that he will do what he sees as in his best interest. And, you know, if it's a choice between Rikers Island and pleading, you know, no contest of some sort, I don't know how he would choose. But, you know, again, the best I could do as a reporter was talk to people who know him well. And again, Michael Cohen, among them, said he will never, ever, ever concede. His niece, President Trump's niece, Mary, said to me that he cannot ever accept losing. And in their family, losing was, you know, a death sentence practically. And so he won't ever take responsibility for this. So I can imagine very much the self-pardon route. It's never been done by a president, but the pardon powers that the president has under the Constitution are very broad, and they don't necessarily prohibit a president from trying to pardon himself. According to legal scholars I talked to, like Jack Goldsmith, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, and he's looked at it closely. It's never been tried. Nixon apparently thought he had the legal power to pardon himself, but his Justice Department at the time did a kind of a quickie memo where they said they thought it seemed illogical because no man can really stand in judgment of his own case. But again, it hasn't been tried. And that same Justice Department memo that sort of suggested that it might not work for a president to pardon himself did lay out the possibility that a president could temporarily step down and make his vice president president, have the newly appointed president who'd been vice president pardon the former president, and then the former president could step back up and resume his powers. And that's the only Justice Department memo that's ever been done on this particular subject. But it does lay out that scenario as a possibility.
Very interesting. And one of the going theories on cable news channels not named Fox is related to what you were just describing, that Trump is setting up to start a new right-wing network of his own, and he gets more of a business boost for launching that by having this fight before he leaves rather than just accepting the results. Your article mentions the Trump News Network concept, but I wonder how that coexists with all the other stuff. And as we run out of time, Jane, I wonder if you have a take on the role of Fox News in any of this. I've been watching them a fair amount, along with many other things in recent days. And, you know, they seem to have a lot of cognitive dissonance on Fox right now. On the one hand, they are calling Biden the president-elect, like everybody else. They're referring to him as president-elect Joe Biden in their news segments. And the more hard-hitting opinion shows are tending to knock Democrats on hypocrisy coming into office. You know, things like Joe Biden says unify the country, but then look at all these Democrats saying they want Trump prosecuted and things like that, rather than really trying to make the election fraud claim.
Well, I think cognitive dissonance is a perfect way to put it. There seems to be confusion within the Murdoch empire, and you've also got the New York Post and the Wall Street Journal all sort of hitting slightly different notes, even hitting different notes on different days. And so there's long been an argument within Fox and Trump, really, about which one of them needed the other more. Trump's view has been that he made millions and millions of dollars for Fox because he was such good box office, and that Fox needed him more than the other way around. Fox has always said, no, we existed before you, and we will exist after you. And I think you're sort of seeing that play out here, where basically the Murdoch empire is beginning, you know, in a sort of a messy way, to break up with Trump and move on to a new future without it. And that's why Trump is also talking about creating his own, or the people around him at least are talking about creating his own TV network that would be just even more loyal and more pro-Trump than Fox is. And he's got a potential backer there for that, a very big one. Bernie Marcus, who's the co-founder of Home Depot, is a multi billionaire. I interviewed him for my piece, and he basically endorsed the idea. Said he thinks it's a good idea for the future to have a pro-Trump network other than Fox.
Jane Mayer, chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Her latest article is called Why Trump Can't Afford to Lose. Jane, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.